Okay, so today I'm here with J.M. Berger, who has written a book. It's a little older, but it still stands the test of time, called Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. So a little background. I mean, you know, when I was in university and I was taking an Islam in America class, right? And so basically, I wanted to do a project on extremism because the class was very good at talking about, you know, African Americans in Islam, slavery in Islam, you know, early America, so 18th, 19th, and early parts of the 20th century, and even sort of the variations in American Muslims, Pakistanis, Iranians, etc. But, you know, the key thing missing from this, you know, master's level course was, you know, a study of extremism. And, you know, when we would sort of go to the professor and press him on this, he says, well, there's not a lot of books that are written on jihadis, American jihadis, or Americans who go overseas to fight in the name of Islam. And, you know, a lot of that was you'd have to do your own independent research. There was no guiding text, basically. But I think with Jihad Joe, you do basically it's definitely a good primer, and it's definitely a good introduction to, you know, this sort of under-discussed element of, you know, of Al-Qaeda and in the global jihad, you know, Americans who are using this ideology in one shape or the other and going overseas. So this is, it's a good book, and it's short too, so it's 200 pages. I mean, I worked through it in a weekend, so it's definitely something, if you're an analyst, a researcher, or interested in the material, I would suggest you go read it. Let's start off with, I think, you know, JM, sort of describe your methods in research, because I would say this book it relies a lot on primary sources, and in the book you do have block quotes of the subjects, you know, in their own words, you know, whether it's, you know, the guy who went to Afghanistan and witnessed Al-Qaeda being born, or, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki. So, I mean, walk us through your methods and your research here.
Sure. So, you know, I started off with this subject really kind of incidentally. I had worked on a couple of different projects that featured Americans who were involved in Al-Qaeda. So first was a documentary about the war in Bosnia and foreign fighters from the United States who went there. And then secondly, I had worked on a documentary about Ali Mohammed, who was one of the key Al-Qaeda operatives in this country during the 80s and 90s. And so a lot of my work had just kind of incidentally spilled over into Americans, particularly. And, you know, around about, I guess it was about 2006 or 2007, you know, there was just a spate of news stories about, you know, discovering, you know, with shock that Americans were now joining Al-Qaeda. And I, you know, occurred to me that there should be some more background on this, because Americans have really been involved with Al-Qaeda from the very beginning. I started off doing FOIA research. That's kind of how I got started with this business for various reasons. FOIA and court document-based research, which forms a lot of the core of the book and a lot of the work that I've done. When we started working on the Bosnia documentary, I also got out and started interviewing people and having more, you know, direct conversations with people who are involved in law enforcement and intelligence and in the movement itself. So I put a real premium on giving people links and footnotes to the resources that I was drawing from. And I've always put a lot of premium on, you know, really letting people's own words do the talking. I think that, you know, we spend a lot of time as writers and analysts paraphrasing what people say, and you know, often the way they say what they say is a much better window into what's going on. So whenever I had that opportunity, and I had both interviews and also just tremendous resources in terms of I had access to court transcripts and wiretap transcripts and different kinds of, you know, online postings and videos, and I just tried to let the voices of the people involved in these movements come through as much as possible.
So let's sort of get into the book now, because I think what really fascinated me, and I think the most, not shocking, but sort of what opened up my eyes, was sort of Afghanistan. And this is 80s Afghanistan. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, the history that we sort of understand of Afghanistan is that, you know, the CIA was aiding Pakistan and the Mujahideen to fight the Russians, et cetera, et cetera. But what is sort of left out of that narrative is that you did have a great deal in, you know, of guys going over there and fighting on the behalf of the Mujahideen, you know, and what have you. So, I mean, describe, you know, the role of Afghanistan and sort of, you know, creating American jihadis, or sort of, you know, encouraging, sort of pushing American Muslims to go fight overseas in the name of Islam.
Well, Afghanistan was really the watershed moment. So, you know, I track the movement back a little bit further than that. There were a handful of sort of precursor incidents within the United States in the 70s, and then, to me, the birth of the American jihadist movement kind of comes with the siege of Mecca, where at least two Americans were involved in storming Mecca in 1979, right about the time that the Soviet invasion started. It was a very momentous time for Islam and for how jihad and violence and extremism in Islam were perceived, because that year you had the invasion of Afghanistan, you had the siege of Mecca, which was a very traumatic event, and you had the Iranian Revolution. And so it was really, you know, just sort of marked the birth of this modern movement. I usually look at that as the start point. And, you know, there were Americans there. There were at least two Americans. One was killed when the Saudis retook the Grand Mosque in the siege, and another one came back to the United States, and his identity has been protected. I've heard rumors about who it might be, but I don't know for sure. You know, he just kind of vanished back into America because the Saudis and the United States were highly motivated to keep the incident quiet. They didn't really want people to know Americans were there, because Iranian agitprop had been claiming that the Americans were actually behind the siege in the first place. So, you know, a couple of years after that, I mean, the invasion of Afghanistan happened that year, and then it took a couple of years for the foreign fighters to start first trickling in and then going in at a higher pace. And there were Americans who were among the volunteer Mujahideen from the very start, as early as 1982, 1983. And over time, that grew. In part, it was cultivated by Abdullah Azzam, the leader of the foreign fighter movement in Afghanistan, and the chief ideologue, and somebody who's still a very potent force for radicalization today, decades after his death. Azzam created an infrastructure in the United States to raise money to help the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets, but it also recruited fighters and sent individuals, you know, over there. There were branches in several places in the United States, most notably in Tucson and Brooklyn, and people who wanted to fight could go to these places, and they would it would be a transit point for Americans who wanted to go over there and volunteer. And some scores did. We don't have exact numbers. Nobody was keeping track of these guys, either the overall foreign fighters in Afghanistan or the Americans who were going over there at this time. The movement at the time in the 80s, anti-communism was a very popular sort of semi-underground movement in this country with a lot of different faces. And the Mujahideen were seen as part and parcel of a broader anti-communist effort, to the point that, you know, Mujahideen leaders came to the United States and appeared at conferences alongside right-wing extremists in this country, you know, overlapping paths with some of the people who were involved with Iran-Contra and some of those other notable anti-communist efforts of the 80s. So, you know, the whole thing was really not seen as a problem here. And so, you know, people could go very freely. You could go into a mosque. Azzam's deputies would go into mosques and release videos and exhort people to send money and send themselves to Afghanistan. And nobody thought that that was anything that the government should really be concerned about. There were a handful of FBI agents and investigations that were suspicious of what was going on here, but none of them really came to anything. And it really wasn't until you get into the 1990s that that there was a mature realization in U.S. law enforcement and intelligence about the threat that these guys could present in the homeland.
You make a great point in the book that during the 80s, you know, law enforcement, you know, the few cases that sort of came up or even were discussed were, it wasn't about terrorism, it was about the Neutrality Act that, if I understand the book correctly, it's Neutrality Act is Americans can't go fight in foreign wars. Is that right? And then,
It's not enforced very often, for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me. I've talked to different people and heard different kinds of explanations, but the bottom line is that it's not a popular crime to prosecute. So there was a Neutrality Act investigation that touched on a bunch of guys in New York and New Jersey who would later become involved in the World Trade Center bombing. And there were other investigations here and there. So, you know, in the Midwest, there were people investigating sort of Muslim Brotherhood and foreign influence in American Muslim organizations around Indianapolis that overlapped with some of the Afghan Mujahideen programs. There were, you know, off and on, you know, somebody would cross the radar. For instance, the New York group was partly came on the radar because they were associated with a gang of bank robbers who at least put on the face of radical Islam and what they were doing, although they were not seen as strong ideological players, but they had overlap with those networks. So, you know, there were sporadic attention paid to this by law enforcement in this country. And the CIA was obviously watching what was happening in Afghanistan, but their mandate did not extend to following people from the United States. So, for instance, one of the people I write about a lot, Abdullah Rashid, who's also known as Clement Hampton L., traveled to Afghanistan to fight and then became a fairly significant fundraiser and eventually went on to become involved in the war in Bosnia before being arrested in relation to the World Trade Center plot. He wasn't one of those direct plotters, but he was arrested for conspiracy around that. And the CIA would track him when he left the country, but when he came back in the United States, that was it. They dropped him. So there were a lot of figures like that who would pop up on the intelligence radar, and then, you know, they would come back to the United States and you know, we had a much different attitudes toward information sharing and interagency cooperation then. So a lot of these guys just got dropped.
So, I mean, before we get into Bosnia, I mean, describe sort of the role of sort of Saudi Arabia in all this. I mean, sort of, because it almost seems like Saudi Arabia in sort of funding mosques and funding mosques with a particular ideology sort of plays a role. I mean, if, you know, not necessarily directly, but sort of, you know, on the side and sort of tangential to all this.
Well, it's hard to find any story about Islam in the United States in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that Saudi Arabia doesn't have some role in. Starting in the 60s and maturing into the 70s, the Saudis took an interest in shaping American Islam. They were concerned particularly about what we would call Black Muslims, Nation of Islam, and those kinds of movements. And they, you know, felt that these guys were straying from the true path of Islam, and they wanted to correct their beliefs and replace them with more orthodoxy. So they had a variety of programs to do that, which started off as sort of smaller scale stuff, and then eventually blossomed into their really taking a strong financial interest in American Muslim organizations that were springing up at the time. And they sponsored a conference in the 70s to sort of lay out what they called it a coordination of the Islamic effort, which more or less meant Saudi control of the Islamic effort in the country, and just tried to get everybody sort of marching on to the same tune. They had some success with this. I mean, they moved, I think, the community more in the direction of orthodoxy. But some of these guys were also involved in more fringe and kind of extremist efforts. And obviously the Saudis were deeply invested in Afghanistan. They put a lot of money into the foreign fighter effort there. But as far as what they did in this country, you know, their individual donors, some of the people associated with Assam, also helped funnel money to these groups. But, you know, the main thrust of the Saudi effort here was more toward mainstream Muslims.
I mean, how would you describe, is what they were sort of supporting and funding, would you describe that as Wahhabism, or was this more sort of subtle that you would, like, somebody would be identified as sort of, you know, preaching orthodoxy and sort of, and then you'd put money behind him? You know, what would be the dynamic here? I mean, is this sort of a direct sort of proselytization of Wahhabism and sort of very conservative Islam, or is it a matter of sort of picking a guy or picking a group of people and sort of funding them and sort of, you know, pushing them to, you know, build a masjid and a mosque and go from there?
Well, the Saudi definition of orthodoxy is essentially Wahhabism. What they did in this country was more of a patient approach. And, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of hysterical stuff said and written about the Muslim Brotherhood's influence in American Muslim organizations. And, you know, a lot of that stuff, I think, is taken badly out of context. But it is true that the main body of Muslim organizations that sprang up in the 70s and 80s were funded and organized by a combination of sort of Muslim Brotherhood members and Saudi members. They took a sort of long approach. They realized that, you know, especially when you looked at some of the variations on Islam that existed here, like the Moorish Science Temple being one of them, which is really like only Islam in the sketchiest. I mean, you don't have to be a Takfiri to say that Moorish Science adherents are not Muslims. But they took on a lot of the trappings of Islam, and the members of that movement were interested in Islam. So really, although they do, you know, what they were promoting was a very conservative form of Islam that we would recognize as Wahhabi or Brotherhood inspired, really they had their hands full just trying to get these guys, you know, praying five times a day and reading the actual Quran instead of creative variations on it.
So, I mean, so this is definitely something that is Sunni, and its orientation would be away from sort of a more, I don't know, ecumenical would be sort of the right word, but I mean, you know, would you describe this as sort of sectarian and definitely focused on Sunni aspect? Because I think, you know, how much do we include sectarianism in sort of that view of not including Shiites and sort of Sufis and sort of the other sects of Islam?
It was definitely Sunni. You know, it wasn't Takfiri in the sense that we see now, where there's this overt hostility and murderous intent from certain kinds of Sunnis toward Shia and Ahmadi Muslims and other sects of Islam. So, you know, they were definitely pushing a Sunni agenda. However, there were Shia and Nation of Islam and Moorish Science kind of adherents who attended this conference that I mentioned in the 70s. So, you know, they were trying to accomplish their goals with kindness, I think, rather than doing it through the kind of hardcore tactics and exclusionary rhetoric that we see today. They were more trying to urge rather than condemn. But at the same time, this Muslim World League was really publishing a lot of propaganda. They published an English language magazine, which I read vast amounts of in the course of working on the book. And they, you know, they did pull out that kind of sectarian stuff. They did write about the errors of Shiism and the curse of Ahmadism, and you know, they definitely had some degree of that focus, but it wasn't quite as extreme as it tends to be these days.
Interesting. So let's sort of from Afghanistan sort of switch to Bosnia. I think Afghanistan participation in foreign fighters in Afghanistan is sort of clear to a lot of people. You know, either because the history is so, it's, you know, so public and so well known, or, you know, because Afghanistan has played a role in U.S. history for the last, you know, 15, 20 years. But Bosnia, this is part of the book that sort of, I don't want to say shocked me, but the history wasn't as clear to me as it should have been. But, you know, walk us through, you know, why were people going over to Bosnia, and sort of, you know, do you think, you know, and what was sort of their ideology and reasoning for going over there?
Well, in Afghanistan and Bosnia, what you saw was that the fighters were less ideological than what we think of as people associated with Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters today. There was mainstream support for the efforts of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and there was exhaustive mainstream coverage of the plight of Muslims in Bosnia. And so it was, you didn't have to be an extremist to get exercised about these subjects and to want to do something. And in some cases, people would travel to be fighters without having as much of an investment as the ideology. So when you got involved, you know, you moved into a community that had sort of this ideological extremism and almost invariably become infected with that. I'm not saying that the ideology wasn't a factor, but it was much easier to recruit because you didn't have to recruit within a pool of people who are already inclined toward extremism. You know, there was just a very widespread support for these kinds of efforts. And, you know, even in Bosnia, which most of which unfolded after the World Trade Center bombing, you know, the U.S. government was very hesitant to do anything that would obstruct Americans from supporting Muslims in Bosnia. So they took a very hands-off approach to a lot of this recruiting, which they, to some extent, ended up regretting later.
Interesting. So, how would you describe people who went to Afghanistan and who went to Bosnia? I mean, are these guys, you know, sort of idiots who just sort of wound up going to these conflicts? Or are we talking about guys with military training, intelligence training, and, you know, I don't know. I think the best phrase I can come up with is sort of paperwork training, sort of the idea that they know how to set up tax shelters, how to move money, how to, you know, create the necessary networks and flows to make involvement in the conflict successful. I mean, describe these guys for us. I mean, in terms of their, you know, experience and profession.
Well, the word that probably covers most of them is passionate. I mean, they were very passionate about what was going on in the world and the situation of Muslims in Afghanistan and Bosnia. And then under that umbrella, there were a lot of different types. There were a lot of people with military experience, but in part that was because Azam and later Al-Qaeda were specifically recruiting people with military experience. That was what they wanted. The old Egyptian jihad network of Ayman Swahiri, which was, you know, side by side with Al-Qaeda from the beginning, was really, had a lot of Egyptian military members, were military veterans and military officers were involved in that. You know, there are obvious reasons if you're staging a war, you know, there's no reason you wouldn't want to take advantage of somebody with military training. You get a higher class of recruit of terrorist, and that isn't even just jihadists. That's any kind of extremism. Mm-hmm. Military recruits are always among the most valued. So there was a focus on finding those kinds of guys, but, you know, but not everybody who was involved had that kind of background. And some people, you know, were, for instance, there were Vietnam veterans who were some years out who went over and got involved in these things. The recruits tended to be a bit older than they are today. So you would get people who had been out of the military for 10 years and had some idea of how to do things, but they weren't necessarily fresh out. They weren't themselves high-end military guys. They'd just gone through basic training 10 years ago.
Interesting. So let's sort of switch gears now. I mean, I think, you know, from Afghanistan and Bosnia to sort of, you know, post 9/11, and to somebody, you know, I think most famously is Anwar al-Awlaki. And so, you know, for those people in the audience who aren't familiar with Anwar al-Awlaki, give us, you know, his origin story. I mean, you know, going from San Diego to Virginia to London, back to Virginia, you know, give us, you know, his basic life.
Al-Awlaki was born in New Mexico. He's an American. His father had been here working on an agricultural project, I believe. And spent the first few years of his life here, and then the family returned to Yemen, which is where he spent his teenage years and a lot of his formative time. When he was growing up in Yemen, the war in Afghanistan was a huge thing, and they would sit around and watch videos of, you know, propaganda videos and videos of the Mujahideen heroics in Afghanistan. And so, you know, it seems like that really sank in with al-Awlaki as he grew into adulthood. So he returned to the United States to study engineering in college, first in Colorado, and he pretty quickly became involved in sort of marginal, more radical kinds of networks. So, you know, there's a spectrum of what we talk about, you know, in terms of where somebody's oriented. So, like, you know, how I use the phrase is I usually use radical versus extremist versus terrorist to sort of show a continuum of where people are. Al-Awlaki was into radical stuff fairly early. He reportedly tried to get some of his friends in Colorado to go to Bosnia to fight. Reportedly successfully got one of them to go. He had some interactions with people from Hamas and Al-Qaeda. We don't know a whole lot of details about that. We know a little bit. People who were doing sort of facilitators for those groups in this country, he had some interaction with them and came to the attention of law enforcement, which sort of poked around a little bit and then put him aside. So he moved to San Diego and became imam at a mosque there and developed a very devoted following there, and started to make a name for himself more widely in Muslim communities, started to become better known, began recording lectures. He did a lot of, he had excellent, really, you know, native English command, and was extremely eloquent. And so he put out a lot of material that, you know, contained stories from Islamic tradition that he fleshed out and really just breathed life into, and did lectures and audios that were really very inspirational to mainstream Muslims. You know, that you didn't have to be a radical to appreciate the vast majority of his stuff is really just, you know, very impressive kind of devotional stuff with the occasional hint of other things that were going on with him. So in San Diego, you know, his some of his rhetoric and his writing had started to become more extreme. You know, the FBI was looking at him again because of connections that he had with known radicals in the community and suspicions of illegal stuff that was going on, but they never found anything that they wanted to take to court. So they opened and closed an investigation on him while he was in San Diego. And almost immediately after they closed the investigation on San Diego, you know, two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Minhar, arrived in town, and it became very close with al-Awlaki during this period. And, you know, this is sort of the thing that everybody who's interested in al-Awlaki is still haunted by, is the question of how much he was knowingly helping people from Al-Qaeda, whether he knew anything about the 9/11 plot. And we don't have clear answers to that, but we do know that, you know, he interacted with them in San Diego, and then a year later, in Washington, D.C., after he moved to take over the Dar al-Hijra, or to work at the Dar al-Hijra Mosque in outside of Washington. So, you know, he had interactions with these guys. He went to Yemen. He took a sabbatical from the mosque in San Diego, went to Yemen. His visit to Yemen overlapped with Khalid al-Mihdhar's presence there, and also Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was one of the facilitators for 9/11. And then he came back to the United States and took a post at Dar al-Hijra, where, you know, his popularity, he really just was a growing force as an American Muslim. He was just very popular, very inspirational. He had a very devoted following in Virginia, which included Nidal Hassan was attending his mosque at the time, the Fort Hood shooter. And then the hijacker showed up again, and they came and visited him and received assistance from him in finding an apartment and a job. He introduced them to people. Again, the details are unfortunately are not as clear as we would like, but we know that there was clear, close contact with these guys. After September 11th, the FBI devoted a fair number of resources to investigating Al-Awlaki and trying to find out what his connection to the hijackers was. And again, it just ended up being inconclusive. After a lot of back and forth and sort of some castle intrigue, Al-Awlaki eventually left the country, went first to the UK, where his stuff started to take on a much stronger anti-American tone, much more overt, I should say. There were a lot of clues that he had this, had some anger and had some radical ideas beforehand. There was a, you know, a fair amount of evidence to support that, but when he got out into the UK, it really became much more overt. It became much more dominant in his thought. And then he left the UK and went back to Yemen, and just continued to become more and more overtly radical. He was imprisoned in Yemen for a while, which a lot of people point to as sort of a turning point for him. I'm not sure if it was, or if he already committed himself by that point. But after his imprisonment around 2007, he became really started to become the figure that people started to worry about, and really became somebody who American intelligence became deeply concerned about his radicalizing influence. People were finding his lectures and his writings were showing up more and more in terrorism cases. And he finally came out as a member of Al-Qaeda, and with a video release and a couple of very provocative audio lectures. And, you know, our understanding is that he took on an operational role in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, which involved both working on plots such as the underwear bomber and the UPS bombing, but also working on media, and most notably and kind of infamously, he played a key role in the development and release of Inspire magazine, English language Al-Qaeda recruitment publication that has garnered a lot of press, rightly or wrongly, since it started coming out in about 2010. And, you know, his life ends, as we know, with an American drone strike. He was killed alongside Samir Khan, another American who was working on Inspire. And although he's gone now, his legacy is still pretty large. His lectures and his audios, many of the writings and lectures he gave are very timeless. They're evergreens, and so they get a lot of play still. They're shared a lot, and, you know, he's still viewed as a very significant radicalizing figure in among English language jihadis. You know, there are other guys who are doing this stuff, and, you know, something that we don't know is, you know, how much Al-Awlaki really compares sort of in a kind of hard data way to some of these other ideologues. And I'd be interested in finding out more about this. I think that the FBI certainly has a lot of hard drives and computers that they've seized from American radicalized American suspects, and I would be interested to see whether there are some other figures who might have a similar influence. I mean, Al-Awlaki became kind of the default guy. He was easy to talk about. You throw him in an indictment because people had reasonably heard of him, and he was just kind of your go-to radicalizer. And he was very significant. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay that. I'm just curious about, you know, where he ranks in terms of other kinds of influences.
Interesting. I mean, I think in your book you touch on something that's, you know, at the time that Al-Awlaki, I think it was the underwear bomber around, so 2009, 2010, I think. Mm-hmm. I probably have my dates wrong, but, you know, in the media, they started talking about him as if he was Osama bin Laden and comparing him to the next Osama bin Laden or, you know, whatever that string was. But, you know, in your research, I mean, would you, you know, did that sort of pan out in your research? Because it almost seems like, you know, Osama bin Laden was, you know, he had fought in Afghanistan. He had the money, the networking, and sort of, you know, bin Laden almost strikes me as a very much a competent manager and a competent sort of, you know, his ability to get the right people in the right room at the right time was, you know, uncanny. Whereas, you know, Al-Awlaki almost seems like he had a blog, a YouTube, and, you know, gave sermons. So, I mean, does your research pan out that Al-Awlaki was or could have been the next bin Laden?
Well, you know, the next bin Laden, the allure of the phrase the next bin Laden is something that is hard for analysts and journalists to resist, and I've been guilty of it myself. excuse me. So there's constantly this kind of pressure to figure out who the next guy coming up is going to be. And in many ways, bin Laden was a pretty unique figure. Although his military exploits were exaggerated, they did exist. He did have some time spent fighting, and he had a personal fortune that he spent building an organization, building Al-Qaeda and deploying its people. He was hands-on with terrorist attacks. He was hands-on with managing people. And Al-Awlaki, I think it's probably minimizing him too much to just sort of say, oh, he, you know, had a blog and YouTube. I mean, he is a potent preacher. He was a potent cleric who appealed to a lot of mainstream Muslims, and his movement down this path was significant because he really he just had such a strong base of mainstream support. I guess, you know, if you wanted to look for an equivalent in American politics, you could say it'd be like John McCain joining the Ku Klux Klan. Not that I'm saying John McCain would do that. I'm just saying it's like the comparable shift, you know? He's taking somebody who's in the mainstream, who has a big following in the mainstream, and suddenly, or seemingly suddenly, you know, surfaces as a terrorist. So, you know, he was a potent and important figure, but what he wasn't, and I've not seen anything to change my mind on this in some years of disclosures since his death, is he wasn't an operational mastermind. He didn't have experience operationally, either as a fighter or as a terrorist. He didn't know how to build bombs. He didn't seem to be particularly adept at managing the people who build bombs. I question, and, you know, I mean, it's possible that there's still more information to come out on this, but I question the characterization of him as a potent operational leader of Al-Qaeda. And when you contrast that to bin Laden, bin Laden, there's ample documentation of bin Laden really not only having a hands-on role in the attacks that Al-Qaeda carried out, but really like micromanaging them sometimes effectively, not poorly. But I mean, he would, you know, there's a famous story about the 1998 East African embassy bombings in which, you know, he was looking over the surveillance pictures and he sort of pointed to a place on the photo and said, this is where we're going to put the bomb. You know, I mean, he knew his stuff and he was effective in that role. And, you know, Al-Awlaki did not have the same kind of resume. He was a cleric who was extremely inspirational and brilliant guy. I mean, you know, I don't want to downplay his intelligence or his competence, but he just did not seem to me to be that kind of really hands-on figure. He seemed more an intellectual of the movement and an inspiration, and that was where he was most effective.
I mean, do you think that maybe do you think there's a generational divide then? Because I think it almost seems like, you know, Bin Laden's generation, you had to be competent, you had to know what you're doing in order to be successful. Whereas it almost seems with Al-Awlaki's generation that you could produce a YouTube, a WordPress, you know, a forum, and really, it's not about having operational control, but rather, you know, encouraging and inspiring people to do attacks. You know, even if it almost seems like even if the attack is not successful, you've succeeded in, you know, sort of terrorizing and forcing the United States, EU, whomever, to sort of adapt. I mean, is there a generational gap and a gap between sort of how these generations conceptualize terrorism?
Well, there's the pre-9/11 conception of terrorism and the post-9/11 conception of terrorism. So prior to 9/11, and, you know, Al-Awlaki was coming up at that time. I mean, he was old enough that he could have fought in Bosnia. He could have been involved in Al-Qaeda proper if he wanted to. And he may, for all we know, he may have been to some extent. But, you know, the idea before 9/11 was that of the sort of, you know, aping the Illuminati or Freemasons kind of idea, conspiracy idea, that Al-Qaeda was kind of intended to be that flip side of that, a organization with deep pockets and tendrils everywhere, but had a top-down control and would deploy resources to carry out attacks. And after September 11th, you know, that central hub, as it existed at that time, was decimated. It became much harder to maintain a presence. You couldn't run training camps because they would be spotted by satellites and they would be bombed. They, you know, the money dried up. You know, key operatives, many of these sort of senior Al-Qaeda guys were killed or detained or otherwise compromised. And in the wake of that, you have the emergence of Abu Musab al-Suri, who's a Syrian jihadi theoretician who put out an idea that had been lifted from the American right wing, which had in turn lifted it from some obscure revolutionary from the mid-1900s, and this is this kind of leaderless resistance idea. So that instead of being a terrorist organization with spokes and hubs and control mechanisms that can be destroyed, you're going to be a popular movement in which people will just rise up and carry out terrorist attacks. And that was where Al-Awlaki had his strength because, you know, look at the attacks that he was involved with the exception of the UPS plot. A lot of these just really involved him nudging people who are on the edge to take action. So you have the individual, you know, the underwear bomber, Mutalab, who, you know, just sort of showed up in Yemen asking for Al-Awlaki, and Al-Awlaki, you know, gave him a bomb and sent him off. You have Nida Hassan, who there was a less clear connection between Al-Awlaki's guidance and Hassan's actions, but, you know, Al-Awlaki provided a background, a grounding in kind of theoretical justifications, theological justifications that underscored Hassan's intention to act on his own. And a lot of these individual jihadists we've seen in the wake of these developments have cited Al-Awlaki as an inspiration. And Inspire magazine, which Al-Awlaki was deeply involved with, has pushed that that theme, that individual jihad theme, pretty hard. So Al-Aki's really associated with more of that kind of the what we, you know, often incorrectly call lone wolves, these small cells and individual attackers who take action on their own initiative without necessarily having contact with Al-Qaeda proper.
So, I mean, it's sort of, you know, evaluating threats. I mean, if we put the online jihad and we say versus, you know, the bullet, you know, what I will call the bullet jihad for, I don't know, it's just easier reference. I mean, it seems like the online jihad is very much, it almost seems like the entropy is there that it makes investigating and sort of looking at these records and, you know, picking who will be a terrorist and who's not a terrorist very much more difficult. I mean, it almost seems like, you know, if somebody has a military experience or is a bomb maker, that finding him or her is much easier than, you know, going through and looking at, you know, websites and, you know, who's using it, who's been inspired, who's not being inspired, etc. I mean, does this make this sort of Al-Aki and sort of some of his successes, I'll put that in quotes, I mean, make the online jihad much more potent and much more, even it almost seems much more dangerous than, you know, sort of, you know, Bin Laden's jihad of the 80s and 90s and, you know, even the more sort of professional, I'll call it that, you know, jihad. I mean, you know what? I mean, is this sort of form of expression of sentiment more dangerous than, you know, somebody like Bin Laden?
It's less predictable and harder to prevent, but not necessarily more dangerous. And I mean, you know, with the reasons being that not many of these guys, these individual jihadists, are capable of doing something like what we saw in Boston, which was, if these guys really had no connections to any kind of professional terrorists, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing was an unprecedented success for individual jihad. Not a lot of people can actually pull that off for various reasons. So, I mean, for one thing, it's not really all that easy to build a bomb without blowing yourself up in the process, especially if you don't have any kind of background and you don't have somebody standing over your shoulder telling you what to do. So, you know, I mean, when you talk about more dangerous, it's like with the old Al-Qaeda of the 1990s, you had guys traveling across Africa trying to buy uranium for a nuclear bomb. You don't have that with the individual jihadists. That, you know, there are ways to leverage technology and leverage innovation to create chaos, to make a spectacle, and, you know, and you can't rule out that there's going to be some kind of super genius type who's going to emerge in this milieu and be able to do some really kind of serious damage. But mostly, the vast majority of these guys, these individual jihadists and small cell guys, are less dangerous. Their attacks are less ambitious as they're envisioned. They're more prone to be discovered before the attacks happen, which is why we've seen so many of these guys get arrested, penetrated and arrested before carrying out their attacks. When they do manage to avoid discovery, their attacks are more likely to fail, like we saw in the Times Square bombing. So, you know, that it's a different kind of problem. My estimation would be that these guys are less dangerous than a healthy, centralized Al-Qaeda. But there's, you know, and they certainly are dangerous. They can kill people, they can hurt people, they can disrupt and frighten people. But they're not necessarily an existential threat. And it's harder and harder as the movement kind of devolves around these guys. It's harder and harder to distinguish between something like what these guys do and a spree shooter or some other kind of mass murderer, which we have with depressing regularity in this country.
I think my favorite line, to your point, out of the book is on page 209. It's, "The most rabid supporters of jihad today are very young converts with little practical experience in Islam fighting or life. They're often not very particularly good at using the internet securely." So, I mean, does that does that sort of, the emphasis on the online jihad sort of force law enforcement people and intelligence people to sort of develop better methods of looking at somebody's online life? I mean, if we sort of describe the threat as nebulous, I mean, what is the sort of counterintelligence, intelligence, and law enforcement reaction to all this?
Well, you know, you and I have talked before about social media and trying to decipher the signal from the noise in these sort of vast seas of data that are online. And, you know, when I talk to people in government and law enforcement, that's what they're interested in. They're trying to figure out, they understand that there's a lot more content that sounds threatening than there is people who are threats, real threats. And what everybody's looking for is kind of the silver bullet, you know, how do we know who's going to be violent? Who, you know, these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, there's, you know, a couple hundred thousand, let's say, you know, online jihadists of significant commitment to the concepts and the ideology, out of which a very small portion are based in the United States. And the question is, you know, how can you look at these guys and see from their online profiles who's more likely to be dangerous, who's really going to act out? And so far, what we've seen is that there aren't real clear patterns for that. So sometimes people who are the most visible online are often the least serious in terms of a real life threat. You know, the guys at Revolution Muslim who made a lot of noise but didn't really take a lot of action. The trick is trying to figure out, you know, what are the characteristics of somebody who's going to become violent. And the sample size is very small. So there's only a handful of American, you know, even though it sometimes feels like there's this endless parade, there's actually only, you know, a couple hundred Americans who have been arrested for terrorism since September 11th. So, you know, over how many years now, you know, 12 years, you know, you got average of about 10 or 15 guys per year, out of which only a limited number of them have online profiles, and many of those are very diverse and different. So based on the data as I've seen it right now, I don't see that there's a silver bullet for this yet, but I'm working on stuff like that. I mean, that's kind of the area I'm interested in, and I've been working on understanding different kind of profiles online and how those profiles relate to people's real life roles. Being able to go into a collection of accounts, for instance, and find people who are foreign fighters out of, you know, there's like 80,000 people following Jabhat al-Nusra right now. You know, how do you go into that 80,000 and find the people who are actual foreign fighters versus people who are just curious or interested? And there's some encouraging, I've had some encouraging results with this, but it's not, I wouldn't call it a solved problem yet.
Interesting. So, I mean, we're closing in on an hour. So, you know, we always like to end the show with, you know, did we miss anything? I think we covered your book pretty well. And I think, you know, I stand by my opening, you know, what I said in the opening, which is, it's definitely a great book and a sort of primer to, if you want to study, you know, extremism, Islamic extremism in the United States, and what sort of, you know, what have been the guiding events and what have been sort of the big issues. So, I mean, leave us with a last comment. Did we miss anything? You know, should we include anything? Go ahead.
Well, thank you for the kind words. And I, you know, it's a big subject. I can talk all day about it. I can write books about it. I could write another book about it at this stage. It's only been a couple of years since this came out, and there's already a lot of stuff to add. You know, it's a big thing with a lot of dimensions, and there's a lot of often, you know, hysterical and exaggerated discussions of who these guys are and what kind of threat they represent, and whether they represent some kind of current in American Islam that people should be concerned about. And, you know, I think ultimately, even if it sells me less books, which I think it has, I mean, I think these guys are not an existential threat. And I think that you need to have a measured approach to them. They are, you know, any idiot can kill people, can set out to kill people, can kill a lot of people if they do even a modicum of planning. And that's something we need to worry about and we need to work on preventing. But, you know, these guys are also pretty inherently limited. And, you know, based on where the movement is right now, you know, American jihadists are something to be concerned about, but, you know, they're not an existential threat, I think. They are a manageable problem that we are mostly managing. And, you know, I mean, I live in Boston, so, you know, I'm very appreciative of the fact that when somebody gets through, when some of these guys slip through the cracks, there's, you know, huge consequences, and there are huge consequences in my town here. And, you know, it's upsetting and angering, and I wish these guys had been stopped. But I think that ultimately the threat they represent, especially if they keep operating in this kind of leaderless capacity, it's something that we can handle. I think America can handle it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.